From KTOO in Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea with this news. The value of investments in Russia held by the state of Alaska, including the permanent fund, have declined steeply since Russia invaded Ukraine, the state's top revenue official said yesterday. Revenue Commissioner Lucinda Mahoney says the value of state-held Russian stocks, bonds, and other investments have declined from $267 million at the end of last year to a current estimate of no more than $15 million. The Russian stock market has been closed since the invasion, but Mahoney says the state plans to sell its Russian assets when it can.
So we believe that the financial conditions in Russia have and will continue to deteriorate such that it makes it prudent to sell these securities and bonds.
Governor Mike Dunleavy and Mahoney said the Permanent Fund Corporation will have to make its own decisions about selling its Russian assets. Russian investments were less than 0.3% of the state's assets before their value fell. Dunleavy repeated his call last week for a series of steps aimed at punishing Russia. He also continued to criticize the Biden administration for its handling of several proposed oil, gas, and mining projects.
Really, it's nothing short of an attempt to snuff out the life of Alaska as a state. And when we need these resources more now than ever, they're doubling down on this stuff. It makes no sense at all.
Both the governor and the revenue commissioner expressed frustration with banks that will not support drilling for oil and gas in the Arctic, but continue to invest in Russia. Dunleavy also called on the legislature to quickly pass permanent fund dividend payments to help Alaskans deal with inflation. He says he expects the state will announce next week that its projected revenues are now billions of dollars more than projected spending. The state of Alaska is moving forward with unloading an iconic state ferry that's been idle for more than 2 years. The Department of Transportation says four parties have expressed interest in the nearly 60-year-old Malaspina. Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports.
The Malaspina ferry hasn't sailed since December 2019. The Dunleavy administration decided then to tie it up at a private facility near Ketchikan rather than invest at least $16 million into the steelwork needed to keep it seaworthy. But even idle, the state is paying upwards of $75,000 a month in mooring fees and insurance costs at the private Ward Cove facility. DOT announced in February that an unnamed U.S. buyer who would keep the 450-passenger ship in Alaska was interested. It solicited proposals from other interested parties and got three more prospective buyers. DOT spokesperson Sam Dapsevich said Wednesday that they're now reviewing those proposals.
Hopefully we'll have something in there that can allow the Malaspina to, you know, remain in Alaska and maybe be used for something that preserves the vessel's historical value and promotes the marine highway system.
Coast Alaska put in a public records request to DOT to find out who was interested in buying the Malaspina. On top of the list is MV Malaspina, a limited liability company incorporated on the day of DOT's filing deadline to express interest in the ferry. Its agent is John Binkley, a prominent Fairbanks Republican. He also owns half of the Ward Cove Dock Group, a partnership with a family firm that's paid by the state to store the Malaspina and other idled marine highway vessels. Binkley confirmed he and his partners are interested, but said he wasn't ready to talk about it. Other interested parties were more forthcoming.
So we like these projects. We like to think big and nothing really scares us.
That's Greg Meyer of Cordova. He and his wife own a restaurant on Prince William Sound. He says his family was sad when the ferry Taku was sold for scrap in 2018. The Malaspina could be redeveloped by beaching it on tidelands that are part of a former Cordova cannery property they own.
That thing has 245 bunks on it. Cordova has a housing shortage, and we have seasonal workers that can never get housing in the summer, so it would help for it to stimulate our economy.
Another interested party is Meridian Global Consulting, an Alabama-based firm that says it owns three vessels of similar size. Here's Meridian's owner, Jonathan McConnell, speaking from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
There's a market out there. I mean, it depends on what, if they're going to ask, you know, $4 million for this vessel, then it's not worth it.
This isn't the first time McConnell has reached out to the state to buy the Malaspina. Last year, he'd offered $625,000 for the ship to be repurposed as a floating barracks. It would house security contractors working to protect international shipping off the Horn of Africa. But now the state says it wants the Malaspina to remain in Alaska, and he says his firm could do that. McConnell says he's talking to partners in Alaska to turn it into a floating attraction.
I think it's a pretty neat experience to be able to, you know, eat a meal on board an old, you know, beautiful vessel that's, you know, to be used as a a museum and also as a, you know, a hotel and also, you know, just a venue to eat.
The fourth interested party is High Seas Limited, which DOT says is registered in India. A BBC investigation last year found the firm had bought an historic British ocean liner at auction, saying it would be a floating hotel in Dubai. But it was broken up for scrap. DOT's regional spokesman Sam Dapcevich says his agency acknowledges there has been commercial interest in the ship, but it wants to ensure that the Malaspina comes to a dignified end.
The state doesn't want the vessel to end up a derelict somewhere because someone bought it and didn't have the means to take care of it, or we prefer that it not be cut up for scrap, like what took place with the Taku years ago.
Other ideas thrown around last year included scuttling the Malaspina in deep water. Governor Dunleavy had also offered to give it away to the Philippines, but state officials say the government in Manila wasn't interested. DOT hasn't committed to any timeline, but says any transfer would have to be approved by the feds because of federal highway dollars used for its upkeep. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
In COVID-19 numbers, state data shows 29 new cases were reported among residents and visitors to Juneau on Monday and Tuesday. That does not include results from home tests. Two people who are positive for COVID-19 are currently at Bartlett Regional Hospital. Today, the Juneau School District reported 3 cases among people connected to local schools, all at Harborview Elementary. Emergency officials say case counts are high compared to earlier stages of the pandemic. The trends are continuing downward. Juneau's COVID-19 risk level remains at level 1, minimal. Statewide, from Monday and Tuesday, 1,435 new cases were reported among residents and visitors. 51 people who are positive for COVID-19 are hospitalized, including 3 people on ventilators. The state also reported that 10 more Alaskans have died from COVID-19. So far, at least 1,201 Alaskans and visitors to the state have died where COVID-19 caused or contributed to the death. Officials in Haines announced earlier this month that its emergency operations center would be deactivated this week. It was created at the start of the pandemic to coordinate the COVID-19 response locally. Now, officials say Haines is no longer in a state of emergency, and management of recovery efforts will move to the borough. KHNS's Corinne Smith reports.
The Emergency Operations Center, or EOC, was activated on March 6, 2020, as a coordination agency for Haines officials to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic. Almost 2 years to the day, Haines Mayor Douglas Olrude says borough leadership met and a decision was made to disband it.
The EOC had a meeting a week ago. Carol Ann Wooten, the EOC commander, called us all together just trying to figure out what the role for the EOC should be going forward. And it was a consensus of the group that we should probably be deactivating and handing over that role back to the borough. We felt it was no longer in emergent crisis.
EOC Commander Carol Ann Wooten wrote a memo to the Assembly announcing the change last week. Olrude says the criteria have been met.
So right now there's a high vaccination rate of over 70% in Haines of eligible populations fully vaccinated. Testing supplies and masks are readily available in multiple areas through the community. The school, the borough admin and search are offering home antigen tests and clinical testing as needed. And we just felt that it's time to kind of stand down, and that if there is something where that comes up, if there's another spike, we can reactivate immediately.
Olrude says the EOC has served as a coordination and public information hub throughout the pandemic. Most recently, it obtained rapid tests and KN95 masks for the community and assisted the school district with its mitigation efforts, including ordering supplies like tests and personal protective equipment. Olrude says that support for the school district would continue.
Those conversations are going to be taking place through the borough administration and the schools and search instead of the EOC going forward.
The Haines School District announced it will make masking optional starting Monday. Administrators cited lower case counts and state authorities clearing Haines of community transmission. That means most recent cases identified have been traced to where the source of transmission is known. A representative with a regional health consortium cited lowering demand for COVID tests at the clinic, signaling a drop in cases in Haines. Will Race with the Juneau-based public relations firm Cedar Group said the clinic administered an average of 250 tests per week in January, about 138 tests in mid-February, and just 30 tests in the first week of March. Search declined to release Haines' positivity rate. Olrud says even as the recent surge of COVID's Omicron variant has begun to subside across the country and Southeast Alaska, Haines still faces uncertainty and mitigation efforts will continue as needed. He says they consulted with local and state health authorities in the decision to deactivate the EOC.
You always look to the people in the health profession when you're dealing with a health emergency. And so getting the information from the state public health office, talking to search, seeing where they were at with their staffing, what they were seeing as far as transmission rates and things, they did not have an issue with us backing off. They thought there's a lot of other communities in Southeast that have already deactivated their emergency operation centers. And so that gave us a level of comfort moving forward that this was the right decision for Haines.
Olrud says the Haines Assembly will have the opportunity to discuss and weigh in on the deactivation of the EOC at its Tuesday meeting. If there is no opposition action taken, the Emergency Operations Center would be disbanded immediately. In Haines, I'm Corinne Smith.
The federal government will fund relocation efforts for six Alaska communities threatened by erosion and flooding. Most are in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, where erosion and flooding are pervasive problems. KYUK's Olivia Eberts reports the project will play out over time, and other threatened communities can still apply for funding.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced on Friday that it'll pay for Alaska communities to relocate buildings and infrastructure. The communities whose projects have already been funded include Kotlik, Alaganuk, Kuigillingok, Golovin, Tintutuliak, and Tununik. What do they all have in common? They're all threatened by erosion and flooding.
We are very excited.
That's Brett Nelson. He's a conservation engineer for USDA. His team has worked to provide flood and erosion mitigation around rural Alaska for years. He knows the communities and their needs. Nelson says this type of federal funding is a big deal. That's because it's a first. Usually the federal government only funds his department to relocate buildings when there's an emergency, like when a home or building is about to fall into a river. But this funding will be preventative, so communities can begin their relocation efforts before it's too late.
Definitely. This is a new thing for up here.
Nelson says the entire process will take about 5 years. It involves multiple stages of planning before they can move into the actual construction and relocation part. But he says if anyone building in those communities becomes urgently threatened, they can speed up the process for those structures. And the application is still open. Any community with an erosion, flooding, or permafrost issue is eligible to receive funding. Nelson says to just give him a call or shoot him an email to find out how to apply. You can head to our website for his contact information. In Juneau, I'm Olivia Eberts.
And a quick note we should have mentioned when we aired a story about a controversy at Wearable Art in this podcast yesterday. KTOO has a media sponsorship agreement with the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council and was a sponsor of Wearable Art. Additionally, KTOO's membership and marketing manager sits on the JAC Board of Trustees. That is it for the KTOO News Update for Wednesday, March 9th, 2022. I'm Jeremy Shea. Thanks for listening.